Translation. During unconsciousness and consciousness and between the two, he should try to understand the self and be fully situated in the self. In this way, he should realize that the conditional and liberated stages of life are only illusory and not actually factual. With such a higher understanding, he should see only the absolute truth pervading everything. Purport. The unconscious state is nothing but ignorance, darkness, or material existence. In the conscious state, one is awake. The marginal state between consciousness and unconsciousness has no permanent existence. Therefore, one who is advanced in understanding the self should understand that unconsciousness and consciousness are but illusions, for they fundamentally do not exist. Only the Supreme Absolute True exists, as confirmed by the Lord in Bhagavad Gita 9.4. Mayata tamidam sarvam jagat avyakta murtina matstani sarva bhutanina chahamte savastitata. By me in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me. Everything exists on the basis of Krishna's impersonal feature. Nothing can exist without Krishna. Therefore, the advanced devotee of Krishna can see the Lord everywhere without illusion. Om Jnanati Mirandasya Jnanana Salakya Chakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Nama Shri Chaitanya Mano Bistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Darati Swapadantikam Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So the conditioned soul in the material world is preoccupied with the material energy and is trying to enjoy that material energy. That is the temporary illusory state where obviously one is getting involved with all kinds of manifestations that are only very shortly there. It is described just like in Vrindavan, before the rainy season it is very dry, and then during the rainy season suddenly all kinds of plants and all kinds of animal life begin to manifest. There are puddles and there are little creatures inside the puddles. But after the rainy season ends, the scorching sun returns and then all that life just disappears. Very quickly, all the green dies out. So in the same way, it is said the material energy is manifesting. So many varieties of things are going on, and what is their true significance? But yet the living being has the tendency to enter into the small temporary reality and take it extremely serious. All the things that are going on in my life. That small and insignificant life, actually. That is very short and meaningless. We are going through six changes. First, things come into being. Then they grow. Then finally they flourish. They begin to dwindle. Then finally destruction sets in. So what can we say? The nature of the material energy is like that. But we forget, and that is the illusory energy. So one forgets again and again. Therefore, once Srila Prabhupada mentioned, he said, the entire body is an anartha. It is an unwanted thing. An unwanted stumbling block on the path of spiritual progress. And then on other occasion he said one should make a bad use or a good use out of a bad bargain. Yeah. So that's more or less the situation. In the material world, once we become embodied, we become artificially limited. It's not actually our true position to be so limited in the spiritual world. The bodies are so blissful and so of opportunity to serve Krishna. Here, the slightest little thing is such a struggle. Of course, it doesn't matter. One can also, with the material body, serve Krishna. And then suddenly, it becomes a perfect tool. Suddenly, that very same body is bringing us eternal spiritual advancement. But then comes the time that we have to give it up anyway. So the material body in itself remains a temporary thing, and one has to remember this aspect. Liberation or freedom from the material world can be attained also by the impersonalist who is not engaged in devotional service. But what is the benefit of such freedom from material existence? What is the benefit of entering into the realm of the Brahma Jyoti if one is devoid of devotional service? No benefit. Because the soul cannot find peace or rest without devotional service. And therefore, again, patantyana dritta yusmat angrahaya. Again, one must come down to the material world. So such liberation is also useless. So both are rejected. This kind of understanding is the position of transcendental knowledge. It is when we approach our situation and we are looking through a perspective of transcendental knowledge, then we are remembering these things. A devotee who is absorbed in service to Krishna may know this kind of philosophy, but may not be meditating on it constantly. May not be constantly thinking, it's all temporary, it's really all temporary, and even liberation has no point. And a devotee is simply absorbed in appreciating how wonderful is Krishna. How amazing is it that we have the opportunity to serve him? How merciful is Krishna? How kind is Krishna? And in this way, a devotee rises automatically above the modes of material nature. Just like Haridas Thakur was engaged in constant glorification of the Supreme Lord. And that is our business, our principal business. It is the primary aspect in devotional service. Philosophical knowledge, kind of establishing the illusory nature. So just take off the garments because they are very strong. And my nose is itching like anything. Can someone take them at a few meters distance? Oh, one sec. You can wear them. Don't sit on them. They're not for sitting. Good, nice. Thank you. So the illusory nature of the material world and even of liberation is there. And it's like, let us say we are walking on a tight rope. And then below the tightrope, there is a safety net, and then there is the ground. So the level of the tightrope is the level of devotional service. where we're just absorbed in serving Krishna, glorifying Krishna. The safety net that we have is the platform of knowledge. That means when we are not able to be deeply absorbed in bhakti, when we're not able to be ecstatic in devotional service, which is really what we should be, but if we're not, then the second best level is philosophical knowledge, the safety net, right? Because the senses and the mind will dictate. They will dictate. Yes, enjoy this material energy. Philosophy kicks in. No, sorry, doesn't make sense. We are only getting deeper and deeper in the trap of the material energy. Therefore, no. So on the strength of philosophy, we have a safety net which will keep us from falling down in the material energy. But in itself, just merely understanding that the material energy, that sense gratification in the material world is illusory, and that liberation is also not desirable, that merely in itself is also not fulfilling the heart. The heart becomes fulfilled by devotional service. And that is the point. Therefore, in our movement, devotional service is in the foreground. Somehow or other, engage in devotional service. Devotional service is that activity which is centered around worshipping and glorifying Krishna. That is our business. It's constantly. Just worship Krishna, glorify Krishna. Our preaching activities, it's also worship of Krishna and glorification of Krishna and nothing else. And that is simply, one must become more and more absorbed in worship and glorification of Krishna 24 hours a day. And then all other things will disappear. Such kind of worship and glorification of Krishna is sometimes privately done, and other times publicly done. Of the two, the public part is most important. To glorify Krishna publicly, that is the process for this age. It is Sankirtan. That is ultimately the strongest element in our spiritual life. But privately is also there, is also required. Just like every morning we are chanting 2 hours of japa, and it's not easy. The mind is drifting, the senses, this and that, distraction. And somehow or other go through the rounds. If we would take the same time every morning and we would chant ecstatic bhajans, would be much easier. So somehow or other, it is easier to engage in kirtan than to engage in chanting japa. In japa, we are alone. In japa, we are alone with Krishna. We are thrown back on ourselves. In japa, we are confronted with whatever Krishna consciousness there is in us. In a kirtan, we feed of everybody else. We feed of the energy of others. And just by that collective energy, the enthusiasm of everyone else, we get swept up and we also feel, yes, very enlivened. But in kirtan, sorry, in japa, we're thrown back on just who we are. And therefore it is more difficult. More difficult. We're not feeding of others. Of course, some will chant japa in a group, trying to still feed of each other. But basically, we are more relying
on just whatever Krishna consciousness is in us, and we're confronted with what is not there yet, and that makes it more difficult. So, both must be there, the public glorification of Krishna, and privately taking shelter of Krishna, and making offerings to Krishna. In japa we can, or in chanting the holy name, we can see two aspects. One aspect is our endeavor in chanting. It is the offering that we are making to the Lord. That's our endeavor. And the other is the mercy of the Lord coming in the form of a darshan, because the name is non-different from Krishna, abhinat from naminam, you know. The name is non-different from Krishna. Therefore, it's interesting how we can produce the sound, and at the same time, Krishna is manifesting himself. And how we are trying to chant nice mantras, make a nice offering, pronounce it nicely, and at the same time, Krishna is giving us a darshan. Very interesting how these both elements are going on simultaneously in chanting the holy name. So we are in that way, on a personal level, relating with Krishna and taking shelter of Krishna. That is very important, because the living being by nature is described as chitkana, or an infinitesimal part of Krishna, also as vibhinamsa. There is amsa and vibhinamsa. Amsa means the parts of Krishna. Those are the expansions of Krishna. They are still Krishna. But the vibhinamsa are the separated parts and parcels. So we are the separated parts and parcels of Krishna, and very minute in quantity. Krishna's energy, the material energy, is unlimitedly great. And therefore that material energy, which is the reflection of the unlimited spiritual energy, is getting its variety directly from Krishna, and therefore the material energy is more powerful than the infinitesimal living being. So in the material world, we are in a very dangerous situation. Very dangerous. Because basically, we are always surrounded by a power much greater than us. The power of the material energy. Always. In every position. Therefore, the material situation is a situation of great, great danger. Padam, padam, yadvi, padam, natesam. And that is our situation, as long as we are in the material world. Of course, there are devotees who can, through devotional service, become jivan muktas. Ihayasya haridasya karmanamanasa gira nikilaswapi avastasu jivan muktasa uchite. One can also already, within the material body, reach a state where one is so absorbed in devotional service that he's liberated from the influence of maya. But otherwise, as long as we are not in that state, we are in a very dangerous position. And only by constantly taking shelter are we protected. That is to be understood. One should not underestimate the potency of the illusory energy. It is very, very strong, very powerful. And if we leave a gap, then Maya will enter. I said, but yeah, it's okay. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. No. I watched the movies and I'm still okay. Yeah. For today, yes. But what we didn't understand is the seed principle. The seed principle is described in Madhya Lila chapter 19, Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is instructing Rupa Goswami. And he's explaining that the Bhakti Lata Beach, the seat of devotional service, is there, and he's also describing the unwanted seeds and creepers that come up and that try to strangle the bhakti creeper and so on. So what we're basically doing is we may take in many seeds. And you think, these seeds are not affecting me. Does nothing to me. Nothing. Yeah. I'm totally unaffected by these things. Even if there are some scenes in the movies that, you know, that are not suitable, they don't affect me. No. That is not affect. They are creating seeds in the consciousness, which will later manifest. Previously, the International Society of Krishna Consciousness was very regimented. Let's say in the earliest days of ISKCON, it was very free form because it was born out of the hippie movement, but then gradually it became very regimented. Like for example, I remember that if there was a book in the temple that was not bona fide, that meant wasn't Prabhupada's books, such books were being burnt, right? They were burnt, finished, you know, in the temple where I was staying. So regularly, books were being burnt. Well, nowadays, you know what I mean? That's like, that would be considered like oppressive, and it could cause a whole debate. If we would start a debate here, should we burn books? You know, and some people might say, like, well, you know, it's like, you know. I'm sure it wouldn't be just over in 5 minutes, a discussion like that about burning books. But we used to burn books, and we used to have a system where everyone was monitored and everything was very tight, very tight. And you really couldn't ever do anything unnoticed by others, and that was the atmosphere. But then, in the mid-80s, the sort of the ashram-based movement gradually diminished, and leaders couldn't keep it up, and there was a great exodus. It was the second great exodus. The first exodus was in 1977 or 78, when after Prabhupada left, and then a lot of devotees just moved out for more space. And in the years following that, that was there. And then in the mid-80s, we got the second exodus of the disciples of fallen gurus. And in that, in the current of that exodus, so many others jumped on it as well. So, at one point you got situations, where you had in some temples more deities than devotees. Alright, so, you know, a little social development. And within that social development, actually, suddenly everything looked very different. Because first we had people who moved out of the temple, and virtually speaking, they had blooped according to the understanding. If anyone moved out of the temple, they had blooped and they were basically not devotees anymore. And then they showed up on the Sunday feast, and that was a real disturbance. What do these guys do? They're supposed to, like, you know. So then the fringy kind of was born, like, and all these things. But eventually what you got was ISKCON was redefined. First ISKCON was the temple, and anything outside of ISKCON was off. Then ISKCON was redefined. We got the concept of the greater ISKCON. Then we had ISKCON, the greater ISKCON, which included the temple and the congregation. And then at one point, there were more people outside the temples than in the temples, and then suddenly the ones outside the temples turned around and pointed at the temples and say, those guys are a bunch of fanatics and a bit weird. They are dysfunctional, and, you know, and just people who can't deal with the world, and therefore they are seeking the shelter of temples and so on. Okay, I'm giving a little history of how things went. Yeah. With that cultural shift in time, also the whole collective mood changed drastically. And in terms of from a collective endeavor and a collective protective atmosphere, it went to a much more liberal atmosphere where, you know, anyway, you know, Haribo, you know, I mean, we can't be fanatics, Prabhu, you know, that won't last, and so on. And suddenly, the responsibility for one's spiritual survival was thrown back more on the individual. Yeah. Previously, it was a matter of just belong to a group, belong to a movement, and the dynamics of that will carry. They will carry you forward, and all you have to do is be part of it. Later on, it wasn't exactly like that. Later on, it was more from, well, it's the individual has to take care of himself. And I think predominantly, we still have more of that these days. The kind of liberal, the majority of our devotees are in that space, and in the space where they have to individually take responsibility, and it's only a minority group that is in a more regimented or more structured type of approach with a collective drive behind it. Such programs do exist, but now they are isolated and rare. Yeah. Therefore, we have to understand that now we are. It's very much depending on us. It's depending on us to take initiative in this particular time. Initiative to be strongly anchored into philosophy. There was a time when in the ashram the atmosphere was such that everyone had to go to morning and evening class. You had to. If you didn't do it, you know, you would be out, right? Simple, you know. It'd kick you out. Kick, right? Throw, bang, force, at baculum. So, in that way, now we're coming to more individual responsibility. In one way, that is a natural progression in life. Because with time, one has to take responsibility. In these verses, we are discussing the sannyasi. And a sannyasi is very different from a brahmachari. A brahmachari is kind of a herd animal, you know, it's a species, they live in herds, right? They rely on each other. They rely on the collective support structure and together. Yes. A sannyasi is meant to be independent and is meant to be an individual, at least traditionally so, who is individually connecting with the Supreme Lord. Traditionally, they would go into the forest, search for their connection with the Lord, and then come out to preach. So he needs to come from that platform of individual absorption and so on. So it's therefore it's such a difficult position, and therefore it is something that is not that is rare in society, should not be taken very often, and is a considering, like I said earlier, that we are all very much at risk until we are Paramahansas, until we are Mahabhagavats, until we are Parisats, until we are residents of the spiritual world. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, they make a division of the amongst devotees. They say sadhakas and parisats. Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami explains. The sadhakas are those who are practicing sadhana bhakti, and the parisats are those who are the eternal associates of the Lord, and they are living in their eternal spiritual identity. And in Krishnadas Kaviraj's understanding, the sadhakas are neophytes. They're all neophytes, and the parisats, they are advanced. Yes, so they are the liberated souls, and everyone else was classified in the CC as neophyte. So even very advanced devotees can still have an element of being at risk. That is something. So therefore, we need a strong safety net, because we may not be at all times inspired about devotional service. We may not always be blissful, although we know that Krishna consciousness is the better way of life. There may be times that it's austere, and although we are full of compassion for the conditioned souls, there may be times, for example, in the summer, when everyone is sitting on the terrace and having drinks and having a good time, and the devotee is distributing books, we may feel more compassion for ourselves than for them. Right? It can happen, yes, that we are... So weakness will attack at times, as long as we are not constantly absorbed in relishing the worship of Krishna. Therefore, a strong philosophical basis is required. And Prabhupada said that his complaint was that my disciples are not reading my books. And this is a fact that we are not absorbing ourselves in philosophy. We're not. We're not reading these books very much. We didn't promise it. Like 16 rounds, we promised. It's measurable. But if you don't read, it's sort of just, what can I do? There's just no time. And that's not an argument. That just means an argument. I didn't make time. That's what it means. I didn't make time to read. I didn't fight for it. Sanatana Goswami is saying that the Bhagavatam is his constant companion. I mean, I really like that. Constant companion. Not just sort of, I regularly read the Bhagavatam, but constant companion. A constant. So he's reading it so much that when he's not reading it, it's completely his meditation. So such an absorption. So it has to be like that. It's not that is for the exceptional devotees. I think within our movement, I won't talk too long, but just this last point, and then I'm going to bring it to a conclusion. I think that in our movement, a mood has developed that a lot of things are for advanced devotees. Right? Like, this thing about Sanatana Goswami and Bhagavatam constant companion. It's for Sanatana Goswami and for advanced devotees. So no, this is actually the normal standard. This is actually the safe platform. And everyone who is not on that platform is in a dangerous position. And I'm speaking irregardless of ashram. Each ashram has its own risks, obviously. And each ashram has its own protection. In every ashram, it should be there. And we see that, for example, Srila Prabhupada describes in the purports to the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he describes this to the story of Satyaraj Khan. Satyaraj Khan is coming to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he receives instructions from Mahaprabhu. he asks, what is the duty of a man in life, right? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says it is to serve the Vaishnavas and to always chant the holy name of the Lord. Vaishnava Sevana Nirantar Krishna Nama Sankirtan. Okay, 3 years in a row he comes. The first year, he said, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that. Satyaraj Khan asks, who is a devotee? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, a devotee is one who chants the holy name once. Second year, same question. What is the duty for every man to be performed? Serve the Vaishnava, chant the holy name. Who is a Vaishnava? One who chants all the time. Second year. Third year, same questions. Who is a Vaishnava? A Vaishnava is one upon seeing him, he automatically makes one a devotee. So, three levels of Vaishnavas described. The Kanista, the Madhyam, and the Uttam Adhikari in those. And then in the purports, Srila Prabhupada describes, this is to the Madhyam Adhikari. And Srila Prabhupada describes, he said that, yes, and therefore it is the Madhyam Adhikari who should be always chanting the holy name. Always. And says like, of course, in the Grihastha Ashram, it's very difficult because there are so many duties. Therefore, the Grihastha is chanting only in the morning, in the afternoon, and in the evening. He says like that. Only. Right? Only in the morning, in the afternoon, and in the evening. Right? It's not like, you know, okay, 16 rounds finished. See you later. To our beat back and so on. No. So this spirit of making an extraordinary endeavor is definitely meant for also the Grihastha Ashram. I'm just telling the story too as evidence for my statements that it is for all of us to be a necessity to become more absorbed. It is due to laziness, it is due to material attachment that we are not. We make excuses, but the reality is, it's not that we don't have time to read, we don't want to. We don't want to. It's not that we don't have time to chant more than 16 rounds, we don't want to. That's what it is. And we have nicely buffered this not wanting with a whole bunch of excuses which justify the whole thing and make it perfectly reasonable. And that is illusion. And therefore, we are still in illusion. Just like Giriraj Das Brahmachari once mentioned to Prabhupada, sometimes I'm in Maya. And Prabhupada said, what do you mean? You are always in Maya. So this Maya is manifesting in this way, that we are not constantly absorbed in hearing, chanting, and in public glorification of the Lord by doing service for that, to spread the hearing and chanting. Yeah, it sounds maybe very rigid and harsh, but it's not me who's harsh. It's the material energy that is harsh. It's like, it's not that I'm speaking heavy. It's Maya that is very heavy, and it takes actually that maximum type of protection. So these verses are describing the sannyasi who puts himself on the edge by taking a vow where any form of sense enjoyment that doesn't come automatically in devotional service is forbidden, outright forbidden. You know, when you're in another ashram, you can go into the supermarket and read the label. And if the label is okay, then you can say, all right, it's bona fide, let's go. But the sannyasa ashram is not really designed for that. So it is different. So these verses are basically dealing with the safety net when we are not yet completely absorbed in transcendental ecstasy. Then there is the safety net of being deeply absorbed in transcendental knowledge. Okay, I'll end then. Any questions, any comments?